Blog Talk Radio.
There's a direct relationship between having the businesses and being in prison. Go find an Asian, see how many Asians you can find in American prisons. They ain't going to be in there. But 51% of your prison will be black because blacks don't have any businesses and industries. There's a direct link. Blacks won't practice group economics. Black won't practice group politics. If you don't practice, you're setting yourself up. I told that five-story building, you're setting yourself to get wiped out. Understand the nature of race, which is economics. If you build the first floor, it's economic. Build your businesses and your industries. Control business and industry, and put that pulls in your money, and hold that money, and practice group economics with it. Arab and Asian money bounces 12 or 13 times for at least. Jewish money bounces 18 times. Black folks got to learn how to practice group economics. Black Americans spend every penny they get outside their own community. Then you take the money and the wealth that you get from that first floor and go to the second floor. The second floor is politics. You then take that money on the first floor and you control your politics. Black folk must quit allowing people to tell them to go out and vote. Vote for what? Nobody's going to do anything for black folk in politics. Politics is controlled by money. Major corporations, who got the money? That's what controls politics. If you have no money, you have no say-so, you have no benefits coming. So you take your money and you control and you take your money on the first floor, you buy every politician on the second floor. And any politician you can't buy, you rent or lease them to get what you need. Then once you get the second floor under control with the politician, with your money, then you go to the third floor. The third floor then is the police department and the court system. You take your money from the first floor and your politics on the second floor and you control the court system and the police department. Then the fourth floor, then is media. You then take the money that you generate off the first floor from business and industries and you go after radio stations, TV stations, newspapers, and cable systems so that you can now inform and communicate with your own people. Right now, black folk own and control less than 35 thousandths of 1% of the media in the United States. Out of 12,000 radio stations, black folk own about 75 or 80. That's all. You own no cable systems. You don't have a daily newspaper. You have nothing of importance. You got about one black TV station. So you can't communicate with your people. You can't inform your people. You can't do anything. You can have Rush Limbaugh and all the rest of the guys talking about racism all day long and bad-mouthing you. And O'Reilly, they can call black folk all kind of names all day long. What are you going to do? You can't respond. You can't communicate with your own people because you don't have an economic base. 51% of all the prisons in the United States are black people. You only make up 12% of the population. That's no accident. It's because you don't control the economics and the politics. And they're going to go after the weakest people they can get their hands on to incarcerate. That's the black folk. And what are you going to do in response to them when they over-incarcerate you? You're going to go out and have a march, a demonstration. We're going to march. March, who cares? Marching has never changed anything.
Many a young athlete entertains hoop dreams. Few, if any, have tried as hard to make them come true as the kid our Steve Hartman has gone to see.
Every week, he set himself up for disappointment. Every week, 13-year-old Jamarian Stiles came to this community center in Boca Raton, Florida, hoping to play basketball with the other kids. And every week, he was rejected.
They'll start picking teams, and I would be the only one left out. And then they'll just tell me, just go home and stuff. You can break someone's heart like that.
The problem was obvious to everyone but Jamarian. He lost his hands and most of his arms as an infant due to a rare bacterial infection. But he insisted that was no reason to give up his hoop dreams.
What about soccer? Have you heard of that sport?
Yeah, hear it every day.
Why don't you play soccer? That just seems like the obvious thing.
You would think that I would be good at soccer. I'm really not. I'm horrible.
Which is why, on the first day of class here at Eagles Landing Middle School, Jamarian took his case to basketball coach Darian Williams.
Yeah.
Said he wanted to be on the team this year.
I said, all great, well, just make sure you try out.
He said, okay, great, but what are you really thinking?
This man has no arms.
Yeah.
How is he going to play basketball? But man, he told me, Mr. Williams, I've never been on a team before. Even if I don't play, I just want to be on the team. And how could I say no to that?
And that's how the Eagles got their first armless basketball player. Jamarian, number two there, quickly earned a reputation as the hardest worker on the squad.
He was usually the first one in the gym, usually the last one to leave.
Still, he sat on the bench most of the season.
Try one more.
Until last month. Coach put him in the game with about 6 minutes left. And when he eventually got the ball on the far side of the court, everyone yelled, "Shoot it!" So he did. And sank. A three-pointer. And if you didn't quite see that, don't worry. Because shortly after, he got the ball again. This time on the near side. For another three-pointer. At the buzzer. Jamarian Stiles, the kid no one would pick, was now everyone's hero. Needless to say, today, Jamarian can play all he wants at the community center. He just made the volleyball team and has every intention of playing football next year. Really, the only thing he won't play is the victim.
If I could wave a magic wand right now and give you your arms back, would you want them?
I don't need them.
You don't need them?
No.
Who needs hands when you've got this kind of touch?
Thank you. Late this morning, I got to juggle my late night hours. As I get up early, I try to get up around 1, and go to like 3:30 and then take a nap and then wake back up, which I was up. But fell asleep. Man, I was up 10 minutes after 10 and dozed off. Anyway, I got to adjust my hours. All right, anyway, today we're doing trending topics. Anything you guys want to talk about, anything in the news? We'll get right back to that after we do Faith Street.
Now, learn this from Joel Osteen. That's my man. He be texting me. That's my man. This God done put some people around me, show me some stuff. He was telling this story. He said this man that went to heaven, and he was walking with Peter down this aisleway, and was going down this corridor, had a lot of doors on it, and said all these doors had names on it. And he said, Peter, let me ask you something. What's all these doors, these names on? He said, don't worry about it. Just go ahead. So he kept walking. He messed around. He saw one of them doors and had his name on it. He said, whoa. He said, hey, Peter, this here ain't got my name on it. Something I need to know? He said, man, don't worry about that. You here now. Just go on in there and talk to him. See what he's here. He said, nah, I want to know what's in the door. He said, you sure you want to see what's in the door? He said, yeah. So he opened up the door. It was a warehouse. It had nothing but shelves on it. And then the shelves had nothing but packages. And all the packages had his name on them. And he said, what is all these boxes? He said, that's all of the blessings, all of the things God wanted to ship to you. But number one, you didn't ask him for it. Then number two, you didn't believe you would have it. Then you doubted him. And then you felt like you wasn't worthy. And so now all these boxes is up here. Now the man standing there wishing he had never even been in the room. And I started thinking. I got some dudes that work for me. And I said, I want you to do this graph for me. And that's what I'm finna show you now. See, what you happen is, when God sends your package, he only sends it to one street. That's Faith Street. You got to stay in faith. You can't move off of Faith Street. You can't get on Doubted Drive. You can't be over there and start doubting it, because your package going to go right on by. You can't lose your faith and get on Not Meant to Be Way, because your package is going to keep going right on by. Because the package just go to Faith Street. You can get your little feelings hurt, I ain't worthy. Guess what? Your package going to keep going right on by. You have not because you ask not. Then you sit up here and start feeling sorry for yourself. You go over on Pity Way, your package keep going right on by. If you stay right on Faith Street, don't ever come off, because the blessing is coming. If you wait on it, here it comes. It may not come when you want it, but it on time. But if you get up and you move off of Faith Street, your box gonna get sent back to sender. And now you're gonna have a warehouse with a bunch of boxes with your name on it that you didn't never get. And I don't know about you, but I want everything he got for me. If he got something for me, I need all of mine. Because I don't know about you, but God lay you out, man. God will give you stuff. Man, he done took me places I ain't never thought I was going to go. I done seen parts of the world I never even thought I could go to. He done gave me stuff. He done put people in my life. God will do it for you, man. But you just got to stay, man. Use these principles of success. Understand, God is just that way. He'll lay you out. Because if he can lay me out, see, if he fix me and change me and get me over here trying to do better, I ain't perfect. I'm just trying to do better. I still say some stuff I ain't supposed to say. You understand? I ain't got it all together yet. I just got in the gate. I'm a new kind of Christian. But ain't no lock on my gate either. So if you see, once you check me, I'm probably going to check you back. But I'm getting better at that. I don't know how to love my enemies yet. I'm getting better at it, though. But it's a process. And the more times we can make people understand that it's a process, the more people can come in. And y'all people that have been good to me, that have been praying for me. I mean, man, my mama, if she could see me now, I just wish my mama could see me. Because she's been praying for this hip all her life. Watch my son. Well, he done watched me, mama. And I'm cool now. And my philosophy is very simple. I was who I was, but I am who I am. And I'm cool with both them people. Because who I was wasn't that bad cap. I made some mistakes, but I've been changed a little bit, and it's still a process. And the more people that you invite into the process, the better this is. Because ain't nobody perfect no how. So I really appreciate y'all, man, hearing me and listening to me. I'm going to ask Kirk Franklin if he will come.
Nah, see, that ain't the way it works, yo. It ain't. Because, like, I'm the one out here all day taking a chance, right? Saying police roll up into this bitch and ain't gonna be you to catch no charge. See, leastwise, the thing you need to do is lay all that good shit down on an even split, yo. Come Friday, me and my niggas done sold all that shit off, come pass and get paid. That's where I'm at with it.
Hey, Frog. Come here. Nah, serious. Come here. First of all, and I don't know how to tell you this without hurting you deeply. First of all, you happen to be white. I'm talking raised on Rapola Street white, or your mama used to drag you down to St. Casimir's just like all the other little piss pants on the block. Second, I'm also white. Not hang on the corner, don't give a fuck white, but Locust Point. IBS Local 47 white. I don't work without no fucking contract. And I don't stand around listening to horseshit excuses like my cousin Ziggy, who, by the way, is still owed money by you and all your down streetwise wiggers. You go in your pocket, come up with 500 in advance and the 210 that you owe to Zig. You can work my package.
I'm saying, this is the shit you had out here last week. The dimes and Moochie was slinging. Shit was good. Moochie sold out quick. Alright. I'm saying, I'm gonna send my man around with the dollars. Keep it real, y'all.
Whatever. Yo.
That was a scene from the television program The Wire, which you can see clips for free on YouTube, or you can rent or buy. I think they had 5 seasons of it. On you can buy it or rent it on. I bought every season they had, all 5 seasons on Amazon. That was a scene where season 2, where I would say you would take a glimpse. The whole TV series is based on Baltimore, Maryland. Season 2 focused in on some interesting characters, which was based on real people out of Baltimore, Maryland. And you got a glimpse at what, because Baltimore is like to a very high degree, a blue-collar town. Not all of them, but it compared to like a Washington D.C. If D.C. is white collar, Baltimore is definitely a blue collar town overall. I mean, you do have white collar executives and that type thing, but it's a blue collar town, and you'll see white neighborhoods that are what I would call a reflection of the real United States of America. These are working class white folks who are on welfare, okay, white folks who are on Section 8, and white folks who are slinging dope. Now, in that particular scene, you had the younger guy, Frog, okay, these people don't, they don't come from trust funds or anything like that. I mean, they're struggling. The other guy that was talking to him, Mike, he was, let's see, I think it is his name. But anyway, the character that he played, he had a job. He had a job working on the Baltimore Harbor docks. And he, the Polish, a lot of the docks was basically controlled at that time. I don't know how it is now. By Polish people, they just had a lockdown on it. They did have some token blacks in that. But, it, you know, it was a union shop, and he was working the docks, blue-collar job, what do you call them, stevedores. But even though he was in the union, you know, he didn't have a lot of seniority because, you know, probably in his 20s in that piece. So to make ends meet, because he had a kid, you know, to make ends meet, he was slinging dope, you know. Now, he probably could have did something else because his cousin, Ziggy, who he mentioned and whatnot, Ziggy's dad was the president of the union, the Stevedores Union. And, you know, at the Baltimore Harbor for this particular thing. So, and they had lobbyists and all this other things, and they were paying the union dues and all that kind of stuff. But Ziggy's dad, you know, was the president of the union, voted in. And Ziggy, I guess for, now Ziggy didn't have any kids with no responsibility like that, but Ziggy was a working class stiff also. And I, you know what? I guess he could have got an extra job or something like that, but in my opinion, he didn't really need, neither one of them need to start slinging dope. But that's what they did. They were also stealing cars off the docks. You know, they, you know, those big containers, shipping containers. They were they had a racket going where they were losing shipping containers on the docks, and they had a side hustle, once again illegal, stealing luxury cars. Okay. And then he would load them into another ship container, and those would be, I mean, it was a hell of a racket. Okay. So it gives you an interesting, like I say, I would call season two, all the scenes with the white characters basically were like working stiff, blue-collar guys. If they weren't getting enough hours, okay, what could they do to feed the kid? They were stealing cars. They were selling dope. And they were doing that type of thing. And I wouldn't call it white supremacy at all. That's just me. But they were trying to make ends meet. Trying to make men's ends. And they had another guy from the Ukraine on there. Just, like I say, Baltimore is a, particularly white Baltimore, is a straight-up blue-collar town. Yes, you do have some executives, but I'm just contrasting it to a place like a Washington, D.C. I mean, it's just, it's there. It's there. Just like if you go to someplace like Flint, Michigan, you have plenty of white folks, but None of them are trust fund babies, and I can't even see where you can label any of them white supremacists or anything like that. But that's my take on it. Anyway, that was from season two of The Wire. Now, so trending topics. I don't have anything particular to talk about. I'm working on what I would call a miracle on this end. So, who's calling me on my tablet? Anyway, 619-768-2945. That's the number to call if you got anything, any trending topics that you want to discuss. Let's see. Matter of fact, let me see if I can find something. Oh, wait a minute. Before we do that, okay, well, let me play a clip while I look for a trending topic. All right, so you got, we got about 6 minutes on this. I'm going to play a clip of a guy named Francis Bach, still living, and he really was a slave in modern times.
First, we present the story of a 7-year-old boy who was torn from his family and sent into slavery in the Sudan. On the morning of May 15, 1986, Francis Bach was living in a tiny village in the southern Sudan. Sent to the marketplace by his mother to sell peanuts and eggs, Francis was unaware that he would never see his family again. His village became the target of an attacking band of slave traders who massacred hundreds of Sudanese, including Francis's parents, and turned the village children into slave captives. He was taken 200 miles from his home and forced to tend cattle in a field. He was property now, owned by one of the slave traders. His welcome was a beating with sticks by the trader's family and a warning that he would be shot if he tried to escape. Treated like an animal and beaten almost daily, he remained captive for 10 years. Determined that there must be a life beyond that of a slave, Francis eventually escaped to the Sudanese capital of Khartoum, and later Cairo, and finally to the United States, where he settled in North Dakota.
And I want you to do whatever you can.
Today, he speaks on the subject of slavery throughout the United States.
I had never, ever witnessed that person before, and I've seen a lot of people who've been killed. You know, I've seen blood running like water on the river, a small river. And this is something that a little kid don't want to see. 7 years old like I, and even youngest kid were in that market. But really thank God, you know, and being able to get away from that situation when nothing happened to me. I was worried. I thought maybe they're going to kill me. You know, they're going to shoot me like they shot some kid running because they didn't mean to shoot them. They don't actually kill the kid. They take them with them. There's somewhere they kill a kid with the parents when they put them in a big hut and burn it with the family. But most of the time when they capture the kids, they take all of them with the women to slavery.
So what happened when you first arrived at your master's house?
I was given to a guy named Juma Abdullah who took me after we divided up to militiamen. And this man took me to his farm. And I remember when I first arrived on his farm, he called the whole family to meet me. Include the neighbors, I can see them watching. And he sent his 3 children to beat me. And all of them were having sticks, and they started beating me. And they were shouting, you know, calling me Abid, Abid. And Abid means in Arabic, black slave.
But there you were, taken out of your life, and now you were something less than human, would it be safe to say?
Yes, I was less than human because they treat animals better than I.
Your final day with him after you, was it the day of escape for the last time?
The last time when I made it away from him,
yeah,
I escaped. He didn't release me. I don't think he was going to release me. He wasn't going to tell me, go back home now to your parents, or maybe, you did a good job for me for all this year.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I give you this and leave. No, he wasn't going to do that. I believe so. He was going to keep me until the time, you know, get sick of me and want to replace me with a new, you know, slave. He was going to kill me or maybe sell me to somebody else. That's what can happen. But I'm glad that I made it away before that happened. You know, I said I'd rather die than be a slave.
So there was a day when you awakened and said, enough. This is the day I go.
Yes. It's a day that I've been dreaming of since the first day that they brought me into this farm. And then 10 years later, I'm still having the same dream that I want to get away from them. Maybe something bad wouldn't have happened that time because I wasn't going to give up. I was going to fight back. I was going to resist with their person. So when I made that decision at the end, the third attempt, nobody saw me at all. I ran away the same time in the morning, 4 in the morning, leaving the cows in a nearby forest and been running all day long on the big forest. And I went to Khartoum, the capital. And I went to refugee camps called Jabrona, where I spent almost 2 years in that refugee camp, where there's a lot of South Sudanese people who left their villages since the war began in 1986, and a lot of people been killed and people all separated. They don't know, you know, rest of the family, and I was actually going around a lot of camps, you know, to really seek for my family, and I couldn't find them. I actually meet people that known them by names, you known them even their parents, you know, and they told me that, you know, since the war began, a lot of people been killed, a lot of family been burned in the huts, you know, a lot of family been killed, shot, you know, men or women, and maybe they are alive and they are somewhere else. We don't know where.
Can you remember a moment when it just hit you, bang, I'm a free man?
Yes, I do. I do when I first actually welcoming by one of the co-workers for the Lutheran Social Service when I first arrived in the United States.
Mm-hmm.
And he took me to the apartment that the Lutheran people rented for me, sponsored me, and he gave me a tour in the apartment, and he left. And I said to myself, with a really big, deep breath, you know, and I said, wow, I am free now.
Okay, you can get more about Francis Bach, B-O-K, B-O-K, this dude, man. Francis Bach, read about him. He was in modern times, contemporary times that we live in. He's still alive. He at one time was a slave. He's no longer a slave. Anyway, now, I'm responding to a text message, paraphrase it. Now, you know, let me put a backdrop on this. Let's see. I'm paraphrasing. Well, hold it. If black folks live in urban hoods with other black folks, or we live in rural areas around white folks, it seems like if we're black, we have a target on our forehead. Now, that's a question mark on that. All right, let me paint the landscape statistically. All right, and we're going to compare it to, I want you to visualize the chessboard too. All right, let me try to paint a picture with statistics and the chessboard. In the United States, with over 300 million people, probably over 320 million people, all right, in the United States, let's put it at 5% for the sake of just easy math or arithmetic. 95% of the population lives on, oh Lord, 95%. Oh, no. Excuse me. 75% of the population of the United States lives on 5% of the available land mass. Once again, 75% of the entire population of the United States lives on or just occupies only percent of the land mass. All right, now, let me give you a visual on that. Imagine a chessboard, or bring up a chessboard online and look at it. It's got 67 squares. 5% of that is represented by 4 squares. So imagine 75% of 320 million people and counting lives, works, and plays on only 4 of those squares. That's about 5% of that board. All right. Now, the other 25% occupy, or they're spread out in rural America, okay, 75% of that board, I mean, excuse me, 95% of that board is rural. That's a lot of checkered spots on that board. That's rural America, and that's where 25% is spread out. All right. One of the thriving communities that are living on the 95%, because the United States is basically a rural country. It's a rural place. All right. Or the Amish and Mennonite people. Now, I'm just putting them out there, the other people. But everybody's familiar with the term Amish and Mennonite. You got, particularly with the Amish, you got a visual. The Mennonite basically are more liberal or more modern, so to speak, than the Amish. The Mennonites, you know, they're not wearing the same clothes. Amish, you know, the men basically have a basic attire. The women have a basic attire. All right. The Amish, you know, and they've got the old school Amish, and they have, you know, the younger Amish and whatnot. You know, some you're not supposed to be using electronics like a smartphone or anything like that. Some do have it. But if you know, their clan found out about it, you know, that's bad news. They can get excommunicated. However, with the Mennonite, they wear what clothes they want to wear. They have smartphones, tablets, all the latest of the electronics, toys and all that. But the common denominator with a lot of Amish and Mennonites would be, number one, they live in the 95% of the landmass that's rural. Dramatically less people. When you have less people, you have less rules, less regulation, less government, which means more freedom. Most of their families are entrepreneurial families. The family business might consist of at least 2 basic businesses. The dad, and this depends on from household to household, but the dad might have a woodworking business where he builds cabins, he builds tiny houses, he builds carports, he makes furniture. All right. And he might make $2, $3, $4, $5 million a year from that business. That is frequent in the Amish community right here in the United States. The men and the women, they also have a business. And it's all family business within each individual unit. She might have a restaurant. Or she might do baked goods, but make, you know, baked shoe fire pies and dinner rolls and things of that nature. And she sells them. And they've trained their children from the giddy up, right from the cradle. They've trained them. They bring them up in the business. Okay. Now, for the most part, they're left alone. Now, you have black folk in the United States. I know you got some black Mennonites. I don't know if you have. But you also have black folks that do the same thing. Now, you do have black townships. Now, every black township that I've stepped me personally set foot in there, I'll name them off. Highland Beach, Maryland, I've been there. To my knowledge, they've never had any racial incidents. And you can look up to see how old Highland Beach, Maryland is. All right. And a lot of these towns were started, they were founded so they can have a safe place to live. All right. So Highland Beach, Maryland is one of them. Fairmount Heights, Maryland, right outside of Washington, D.C., is another one. North Brentwood, Maryland. These are all places I personally have set foot in. That's another place. Never any racial violence. All right. 45 minutes from where I'm at right now, Eatonville, Florida, over 100 years old, no race problems whatsoever. All right. Oklahoma, Tampa, Oklahoma, I've been there several times, no racial problems. Tallahassee, Oklahoma, where I had dinner with their mayor, no racial problems. All right. Summit, Oklahoma, I've been there twice. No problems there. All right. Now, I know somebody might be saying, but what about Black Wall? Black Wall Street was a neighborhood within the city of Tulsa, Oklahoma. That was not a black township. Now, I forgot. Up in Illinois, Hopkins Park, Illinois, I've been there. All right. And they also classify Pembroke, Illinois, as a black township. I've been there too. Up that neck of the woods, they say they're both the same. But to give you a visual on it, Pembroke, Illinois, was there first, and then Hopkins Park is a village within Pembroke, Illinois. All right, which was I think originally started by three families. All right, three black families. But anyway, so historically, areas, and like I said, there's a lot of land in the United States. 95% of the land is unurbanized. Let me give you another visual. The United States has 19,500 municipalities in the United States. Now, there are more communities than that, but those are just the ones who have a municipal charter. New towns are forming, if not every day, every week or every month. One of the towns... And it's the first step is buy some land and establish a settlement. Now, one of those towns I've talked about for the last couple of weeks is, and they're starting it. They have started it. They bought the land. And they're doing activities on the land right now in their settlement. Freedom, Georgia. Now, if you go online and you type in on YouTube, Freedom Georgia, they've got about five videos on the site. I haven't been on there in about a week or so, but last time I was on it, which was within the last 2 weeks, they had five videos on it. They started with 97 acres. Actually, to be exact, they started with 96.71 acres. Now they're up to 502 acres. All right, and thus far, and they're new now. They're still camping out in tents there on their 502 acres. But this is a community organized by, it started with the idea of two black women. That's how it started. All right, and they organized 19 families, and each one of them has at least 2 acres each. All right. Like I said, they've grown to 500, so they probably have more than 19 families now. But so far, and they got smartphones and internet connections and all that, they have not had any racial problems. Now, there is one video on the YouTube that, because there's always somebody trying to make us into victims. It is interesting, because in the one person that made a victim, attempted to make a victim story, and this is a black person too, out of that, well, what they done, this person themselves, who's a black person, they haven't done anything. But you don't hear any kind of victim stories out of these people that have got 502 acres so far. They'll probably get up to 1,000. All right. Attitude and points of view mean everything, in my opinion. So, now there's another group in Georgia, a group of people, 12 people, I think most of them out of Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. I know at least one or two, or at least one out of Ohio, but they're in Philadelphia. But all black, 12 black people. They bought, so far to my knowledge, they've bought, and I'm going to get one of them to speak on here. Hopefully maybe, well, if not tomorrow, next week. So far they've purchased 110 acres of land. And I haven't heard anything negative about that. This country is big enough. This country is big enough and wide enough where no matter the way I see it, including black folk, you can set up your own thing and nobody bothers you. Because Eatonville, once again, Eatonville, Florida, is over 100 years old. And you got white townships right near them. Matter of fact, Orlando, Florida, is only 6 miles away from Eatonville. But Eatonville has never suffered or experienced any type of racial trauma. So, from my point of view, your observation, really, when I speak of Eatonville, when I speak of Fairmont Heights, and I can repeat this 800-900 more examples that exist right here in the United States today. None of them, I mean, how can you explain it? Eatonville, over 100 years, no problem. Tampa, Oklahoma, over 100 years, no problem. Tallahassee, Oklahoma, over 100 years, no problem. Anyway, so there's a lot of space out here once again. I think rural America is where it's at. Now, when you're in the larger cities, okay, you know, where then competition comes into play. You know, supply and demand comes into play. You know, why does it cost more to live in New York City than some small place in upstate New York? Simple, supply and demand. More competitive prices. More competitive everything, you know. But if you, you know, you got people that are struggling in New York City right now. They would find a whole new way of life if they drove 90 minutes outside that town. Instead of paying, let's say $800 a month for a room in New York, let's say Manhattan, New York, and we got to get somebody on here from Manhattan. You know, drive I said 60 to 90 minute radius of Manhattan. You can find something sustainable. Just like if you're struggling in Chicago, not once again, this is based on what I personally have seen and experienced myself. Drive 45 minutes, give yourself a 45 minute to an hour radius of Chicago. You can go to an area where you're struggling in Chicago for the same amount of money or less. You can live in a sustainable situation and have more with less money. And that includes dealing with law enforcement. Most of the incidences that we have seen, encounters of particular black homicides with police officers, law enforcement, has basically happened in urban situations. Now, I'm sure there's some, like there was one case in Texas that happened in a, and the guy knew the guy too, but that happened in, I guess, a suburban situation. But I would say well over 95% of the cases, you know, where to Trayvon Martin happened in an urban situation. George Floyd, urban situation. I forgot the case that happened in New York Eric Gardner, urban situation. Mike Brown, urban situation. But there are black people that live in Bangor, Maine. You don't hear anything about coming out of Bangor, Maine. If it did, you'd hear about it. Because that's the way this country thrives off of racial incidences. Nome, Alaska. Fairbanks, Alaska. Juneau, Alaska. Bismarck, North Dakota. Sioux City, South Dakota. Idaho. Now, I was sent the video a few days ago. And this lady who is in Idaho, could be Boise, was walking down the street and somebody rolled out by on a bike and called her an N-word. But you can be walking down the street in Chicago in an all-black neighborhood and be called the same thing. Now, are you more likely to get shot if you're black in Boise, Idaho, walking down the street, or in Chicago, Illinois, or New York City, or Los Angeles, California, or San Diego, California, or Dallas, Texas, or Houston? I'll take my chances in Idaho before Chicago. I'm just saying. But it's up to individuals because everybody's got their different experiences and tolerance rate and this, that, or another. But I personally think the safest place, you can live in a rural area. And have, I mean, if you buy your next door, you can have a setup in a rural area, particularly if you buy by the acre, where your neighbors won't see you. Matter of fact, we had a guy on here, we've had him on here twice, it's time to bring him back. young guy. He's in his 30s, maybe 40s. He lives out in Oklahoma right now, and his neighbors are white. And he hasn't had any problems out of them. And he's on about maybe 2 or 3 acres, something like that. And he's living a very sustainable life. He's good. So I'm just saying, from my point of view, no matter what race you are, living and going rural or having a rural spot that you can call your own, okay, where if you want to just go chill out in the country or you want to live there full time or have it as a backup plan, or a bug out spot, I think everybody should have one. If you can arrange it, do so. And I just think living in rural areas is just a safer place. You don't have to be isolated, because there are plenty of rural areas where there are plenty of towns that have, 50 people, 100 people, or what have you, and everybody knows everybody. I've been in places where you can sleep with the door wide open. You got a screen in there. So you don't want no wild animals coming up in your house. But I've done that in recent years. And it's this particular place was maybe 15, 20 minutes away from the nearest Walmart, the nearest T-Mobile, shopping mall, commercial areas and all that other stuff. 15, 20 minute drive. Some people, I've been in towns where some people who don't have a car, during daylight hours, they'll walk from their small town into the larger town. It might take them 45 minutes or an hour to do it, but, they knock it out. So in any event, that's my take on that. It is Thursday, man. This week has gone by quick. If you got any topics that you guys want to discuss tomorrow, let me know. Or if you got anything that you want to chop it up on right now, just let me know. We'll put it up there. Let's see. I'm looking for. Let's see. I need to get. Well, anyway, I don't want to play any other audios on here. Okay, I don't see. Okay, like I said, we got started a little bit late today. But I like this trend. I consider the trend of what Freedom Georgia is doing matter of fact, we got some. Well, anyway, I don't want to announce anything right now. Okay. All right, well, we got at least 14, 15 more minutes of time. If you guys got any topic that you want to discuss, press 1. Let me see. Pat Tedder. Pat Tedder. Pap Tedder was one of the founders of Hopkins Park, Illinois. Now, let me see if I got this right so you can hear something.
right surroundings and encouragement, I'll bet that that man could run our company as well as your young one thought. Are we talking about a wager, Randolph?
What name is going on here?
He tried to rob the payroll, Randolph. He attacked me in broad daylight.
Oh, no, that's not it. Pap Cheddar.
I was toting my pack.
No, we're not ready for that. Let's see. Let's try this one.
People in the stands. I mean, that's just like what's entertainment for me now, you know? I like that Jimmy the Greek moment that happens in sports, you know? Like once every...
Okay, Pap Cheddar. Look him up. T-A-P, Pap Cheddar, T-E-T-T-E-R. As a matter of fact, before we log off here, let's see. Let me read to you what I can find. All right, Pap Cheddar. Okay. No, I don't want that. Let me see. Pap Cheddar. Pap Cheddar. All right, Joseph Pap Cheddar. He's the founder of, one of the founders of Hopkins Park. Let me read this, okay. All right, the village of Hopkins Park, now they have it established 1972. Pap Cheddar, now this goes back to 1862, though, all right. It was probably incorporated 1972. All right, this is about Hopkins Park, Illinois, which is a black community. Pap Cheddar, a freed slave, his wife and 18 children arrived in 1862 after a long, arduous wagon trip from North Carolina. Pap Cheddar established in Hopkins Park on 42 acres in early 1862, when the land was sparsely populated collection of wetlands, prairies, and old oak savannas. The Civil War was being fought at the time, and slavery was still an institution in the South. They settled near the state line about a mile east of the original village of Hopkins Park, where Sacred Heart stands. There are descendants of Pap Cheddar still living in Hopkins Park today. Hopkins Park was a settlement African-American pioneers established after moving out of southern slave states. Some historical document, now let me stop for right there. If you want to start a town of your own, the first legal step that you must take is to find a patch of land and buy it. Now, you'll be legally, that's your settlement. You can call it a ranch if it's big enough. You can call it a ranchette, which is a small ranch. You can call it a compound. All right. Now, each state has their own legal requirements for you to call it a town and then a village and a town, a city, and that's all based on population and voting and all this other stuff. But to keep it real simple, find yourself a patch of land and buy it. That's your first step. Now you can keep it low profile, like Blackjack, Illinois. That settlement, which is right next door to Taft, Oklahoma, which now TAF is incorporated. Blackjack is not. But in my opinion, Blackjack, the citizens of Blackjack, Oklahoma, have more freedom because they're not incorporated. All right, but in any event, back to Hockman's Park. Hockman's Park was a settlement African American pioneers established after moving out of Southern. Sorry, we read that. The pioneers found something familiar about the ecosystem that reminded me of the origins in either the Southern states or Africa, which helped them survive. The village of Hockman's Park continues to thrive. I mean, survive, fight, and grow. The population was around 650 residents to date. The village of Hockman's Park is a home rule, is a home rule community with the potential to have a manufacturing industry and commercial business economic development. Look, it's just like the Amish. I mentioned on here within the last couple of months, we did a piece on Yoder, Kansas, population 165. Freedom, Georgia, once again, two black women with an idea. And 19 families, black families, bought onto that. Their settlement now has spread out. They didn't start at 502 acres. They started out with 96.71 acres. But there are other stories, other towns and little villages that have been left alone for well over 100 years that started off with one person who bought some acres for themselves, and they didn't go to the government. There was no social services office, and they have never been touched by racial violence. So my whole thing, I'm saying that was to say this, and this is why I like to use the chessboard so much. Avoid places where there's a lot of competition. Where there's a lot of competition, you stand out. And the nail that sticks out, no matter what color or race, the nail that sticks out eventually will get hit. Typically, in your lynchings and your racial crimes, typically, the hardcore racists, they don't go looking. They don't even look. People don't think about it. Most crime that happens within a geographical area happens within a 60-minute radius inward, not outward. The majority of people that got shot up, that got killed in Chicago, got killed in Chicago. You don't hear nothing about happening like this out in Hopkins Park or Pembroke, Illinois. I'm sure they do have their crime, but not at the prolific level that you might find in Chicago or Los Angeles or New York City or Boston or someplace like that. Like I said, Edenville is 45 minutes. It's 6 miles away from Orlando. Trayvon Martin didn't get killed in Edenville, an all-black township, 6 miles from Orlando. He got killed in Orlando. Ahmed Aubrey. He didn't get killed in the black township. He got killed jogging through a white neighborhood. I I don't think it's rocket science. Hey, but that's me. Let's see. Okay, if I can, I got to find myself. Wait a minute. No, that's not it. I gotta find my studio. So, oh, let me go do that. Okay, let me see. Okay, I have to open up a new window. Okay, anyway. All right, well, that's my take on it. All right. Well, actually, if you guys got anything for tomorrow, let me know. We're preparing to get into the new year. Okay, wait a minute. We're not going anywhere just yet. Let me see. All right, well, look, everyone have a good rest of the day.